And it's certainly starting out anyway was not for the money or for you know, for lack of getting yelled at by fans by any means, but it was really to give something back to the sports that I participated in both in high school and in college. And so it was just a way for me to give something back. The alternative was you could go into coaching, but we did have or still do have a large contingency of officials here in the Bloomington Normal area, and it was really kind of a hot spot for a lot of officials growing up, and one of them being Wayne Meese, who I think when I was in college was working in the Big Ten, and then Steve Newman, who is now a replay assistant in the Big Ten, John Sullivan, Chuck Feeney, were all guys that were all mentors and kind of pointed me in the right direction. So, you know, just giving something back, and I learned to love it, and it was, you know.
What about it do you love, though?
You know, I think it's not only, you know, being out on the field and being part of the game again anyway. I love being with the guys that you work with. It's a unique group of individuals, and they come from all walks of life, everything from attorneys to school teachers to principals to financial planners, pilots, you name it. It's kind of, you know, we have a big variety of guys that also have full-time jobs, and that's what makes this kind of unique from that standpoint, is that we're not full-time employees of the National Football League, but it's kind of a, you know, it started out as a hobby for most of us.
How much are you together on the road?
The crew involves seven officials and two replays, so there's nine of us. We do stay together the whole season, and so that would be for like 16 regular season games and then four preseason games. So that's 20 weeks, and then we are at clinics together for, you know, for another couple more weekends and stuff. So it becomes your second family.
And if you're the top-rated crew, maybe you get to do the Super Bowl.
And exactly. Usually the top-rated crews will work in the wild card round or the divisional round. And that's, you know, generally the top eight crews. And then for the championship game and the Super Bowl, that's an individual selection. It's usually your top three to five individuals in each position.
What makes a tight crew, and how much actual teamwork is there other than just handling your own section of the field and your own task?
There's a tremendous amount of teamwork involved. When you go on the field with seven other officials, you have to trust that your partners are going to do their job looking in their particular area. And, you know, that trust, you know, it's what makes really the crew work in itself anyway, and you've got to have people that are willing to step up at times and make particular calls. You also have to have officials that are willing to, you know, perhaps officiate outside of their box, so to speak, to help out a partner. Tight catches on the sideline, for instance, or tight catches in the end zone, fumbles, what have you. You know, the guy that's closest to the play may not have the best angle of that particular particular play, so you've just got to have that continuity between the guys that you're working with, and you've got to have that trust that those guys will step up and make the call.
You've gone from high school officiating to college Division III to Division I to Canadian football to the NFL in 2001 to the playoffs and to the Super Bowl. What were the challenges you faced in this one?
It's controlling your emotions. When I look back, no matter what you do, there's hype. There's hype involved in the coin toss. There's hype involved in the national anthem. There's hype involved in the kickoff. And that hype is exaggerated to a certain degree because it is entertainment. So that exaggeration just kind of magnifies it, you know, 10 times anyway. So maintaining your control of your emotions so you don't get caught up in a lot of the hype was probably the major thing that other officials who have worked the Super Bowl had suggested to me and made the comment anyway, is, you know, don't get caught up in with your emotions and the hype.
How do you tamp that down? I mean, what mental work do you go through to keep a lid on it?
Just the process that you would normally go through just during the regular season is a lot what I did, and that's focusing on that this is just a, you know, a football game, even though the stakes are a lot higher, but it is just another football game from that approach. And, you know, running through your keys, running through the procedures that we do in between downs. All of us have a different strategy when we're on the field of what we're doing during the dead time anyway. So it was focusing on that, making sure that all that was kind of in line when you walked out on the field. And again, just treating it like a regular season game from that standpoint, even though, you know, the...
And were you successful?
Yes, I did feel comfortable. It did take me 3-4 minutes anyway at getting into the game to get into your routine, just simply because of, you know, it was the final game of the season, and there were a lot of eyes that were watching that particular game. So, yes, I was successful in getting through that process.
How has review affected how you feel about your work and how you go about it?
To me personally, I like it. I like it from the standpoint that we officials, we're human. We're going to make mistakes on the field, mistakes on catches or fumbles. That all comes into play into the game. So it's kind of comforting to know that they've got this system put into place where it can be challenged on a particular play, where a coach can he actually has coaches up in the press box that are watching the TV monitors and what have you while the game's going on, and they're actually responsible for buzzing down to the head coach to let them know whether to challenge a play or not. But I like it from the aspect of if I do make a mistake, it's nice to know that it can be corrected, and it can be corrected right away, and I don't have to be concerned about whether my judgment in that particular play meant winning or losing the particular game anyway. So I can get on the airplane on my trip home anyway and at least feel halfway comfortable that, you know, you gave it your best shot and the game was officiated correctly.
What's your most memorable mistake?
Oh, I've had a lot of them, Charlie. <It's>, and I say that there's a lot of them that I scratch my head on anyway. And I don't know if they're mistakes or not, but one of my memorable games was early in my career, my second year in the league. I was assigned a playoff game that involved the New York Giants and the San Francisco 49ers. And there was a field goal attempt that on the very last play where the field goal holder muffed the snap, and eventually there was a ball thrown and some pass interference occurred, and that wasn't called, and the Giants ended up losing by, I think, 2 points in that particular play anyway. And you know, hindsight's a wonderful thing, and we go back and look at the film, and we probably should have had a flag on the play and given New York another opportunity to kick that field goal. But you know, there was a lot of variables in that particular game anyway that made it interesting.
How do you avoid becoming gun shy once you've done something like that?
And again, it's kind of experience and it's a mental, it's kind of, what do I want to say, a lot of mental looking at plays on video and I'm going to call it mental toughness, I guess, anyway. But you have to work your way through that. You have to, particularly when you're on the field, and let's say I may have made a pass interference call and it made him perhaps could have been incorrect or whatever. And the thing is, though, I have to get right back into the right frame of mind right away, because the very next play could come right at me again and where I need to make a judgment call on whether it might be pass interference or a catch, no catch type situation. So there's a process there that is kind of a mental process that you've when you make the call, you got to accept that you made the call, right or wrong. If it happens to be wrong, you can't worry about it now because it's history, and you got to move on to the next play.
In tennis, Andre Agassi always talked about, after a point, doing the exact same thing as a physical key to help you get back into the mental frame that you need to resume the play. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and, you know, there's a lot of correlation there to a lot of different professional sports, golf, tennis, being is that, you know, you've got to get back into that routine, and you've got whether it's ball striking or whether it's officiating, you need to get right back into that routine as soon as possible. If you don't, you just set yourself up for another mishit or another error.
So what is the routine? What is the physical process that you do to reset mentally as well?
You just have to tell yourself, you've got to move on beyond this play. You've got to accept it, and you got to be able to accept the criticism, you know, after the game is over. And that criticism may be in the form of learning. It's constructive criticism. I mean, they're not there to yell at you by any means. But you need to learn from it. And it's like an experience thing that the longer that you're in the league, the more experience you have at those particular plays. And not that you're ever going to see all types of plays that could ever possibly happen, but just having the experience of knowing that, okay, maybe I booted that call, you accept it in your mind and say that I made a mistake, and you move on. And the faster you do that, the better.
In Andre Agassi's case, he was talking about, you know, going back, grabbing the towel, wiping his face a certain number of times in a certain way, going back to the service line, bouncing the ball a given number of times.
Right.
Not more, not less. Is it that kind of physical repetition that helps too?
It is, except we have a shorter period of time to do that. There's approximately 35 seconds in between each play, so we have a 35-second period of time in there to gather yourself, and get your thoughts collective, get back into your routine, get ready for the next play. You got to count players. You got to know what your 5-yard belt is for illegal contact. There's just a lot of things that you got to get right back into that procedure within that period of time so you're ready to go.
What are the toughest calls for you to make?
Well, for us, a lot of the calls that I make will be pass interference calls, offensive pass or defensive pass interference. So
inbounds reception?
Those kind of come with experience. You just have an instinct that you develop over the years that these guys are that good that chances are if you don't see the ball on the ground and they've got it in their hands, chances are they've stuck 2 feet inbounds. Not that they're all easy. I mean, they're just as difficult as some of the judgment calls. But the pass interference is a judgment, and that's a judgment call which can't be reviewed. So those are the tough ones.
Okay. When coaches or players don't like a call, they tell you about it. What's the most memorable reproach you've ever received?
I would say that probably goes back to my college days. You know, I worked for guys that were on the sideline. Give me a second here, Coach Cooper at Ohio State, and Coach Carr at Michigan, Coach Paterno at Penn State. They all had their own ways of letting you know on which way the call should go.
So what does Paterno do?
Coach Paterno in just in a classy way, and I was only on his sideline maybe once or twice during my 4 years of the Big Ten because in college, the positions, we don't switch at halftime, where in the NFL, I'll be on one team the first half and I'll be on the other side of the field on the second half. In college, we don't switch, or we didn't switch at that time. And so I only had him a couple times, but, you know, in a very classy way. I never he always had some assistant coaches on the sideline that liked to do a lot of that work for him anyway. So, I give him credit that very classy, very personable guy from that standpoint that wasn't a lot of yelling, but, you know, they always sneak up behind you and like to, you know, chirp in your behind you a few times anyway.
Okay. Are they funny?
Oh, sometimes they're hilarious. Sometimes, I mean, it's can be some of the most comical lines that you've ever heard anyway. And obviously some of them are probably not repeatable on the radio or on any media service anyway. But
you remember one or two that are?
Oh, you kind of caught me off guard there. I kind of,
okay.
Sorry about that.
That's fine. One baseball ref told me once the magic word a player or manager uses to get tossed out of the game in baseball is not profanity. It's the word you, as in making it personal somehow, making the criticism personal. How do you approach interactions with players or coaches or even fans? And they do heckle.
They do, yeah. Again, you've got to have broad shoulders and you've got to be able to handle those types of situations because they're going to occur. And, hopefully they don't occur every game, but when you do get them, you try to talk to the coach in a very calm and a very personable. You treat them very respectful and you let them kind of release that energy that they've built up anywhere concerning that particular play. But I always ask the question after they're done or while they're perhaps chewing you out on the sideline is coach, please tell me what you saw. And once he's done that, then I will let them know what I saw. And, we just try to treat it in a very business manner as opposed to a lot of yelling and screaming on the sideline. It doesn't do anyone any good when you get in a confrontation. And from an official standpoint, you're never going to win. You're never going to win when you're trying to battle a coach.
Okay. Why do you wear number 67?
The number's assigned by the NFL. That is a number that once you're given that number, once you're assigned that number, very rarely do guys switch that number unless they had a favorite number while they were in college or high school or whatever, and that number now becomes available. Sometimes they'll ask to switch. But once you receive that number as an assignment, then it stays with you your whole NFL career.
Have you worn 67 before the NFL, though?
I have not. Nope. Oh, in college, there's no numbers. 67, I did receive that when I was working in the NFL Europe League, and it just happened to stay with me from the NFL Europe League over into the NFL.
Okay. You are in your early 50s. You are running around on a field with people in their 20s and 30s who are among the fastest people around. How do you keep up enough to be able to see what you have to see?
Well, it's you just hope that you're in shape and in condition and hope that you maintain some of that speed that you had when you were, 20 years ago anyway. We are required to take an annual physical and an annual stress test every year for the NFL. And up until a couple years ago, we were actually timed on 40-yard sprints and doing some different other type of functions anyway with running and stuff. However, we don't do that now. But you are expected to be in the right position in order to make the calls, and film will show that. And when you're not in the right position to start making or to make the calls, then that'll be reflective in your calls. And too many misses by not being in position is one of the things that the NFL looks at and one of the things that they're going to address. And if it's a big concern, they could let you go.
So what is the upper age limit for an official where they can physically keep doing it?
Oh, we've had guys as old as 68. I think we just had one retire a couple of years ago. It was 68 years old, I think working the referee position. So, normally I would say once guys get in maybe around 20 years or whatever, that's kind of what they look at as far as a barometer of when things are going to start moving a little bit faster than what they might be used to.
How much work is it for you to stay in shape?
Oh, it's a year. I put as just much time into working out on a weekly basis as players do. I may not do it as hard as they do, but I'm in the gym 2 to 3 hours for minimum 4 times a week, if not 5 times a week. I enjoy, doing some running and I do some cross training with just some free weights and some machine weights and what have you. But I'm not there to bench press 225 pounds 30 times. That's not my goal. My goal is just to stay in shape and look the part. Fitness is one of the criteria that we're graded on anyway. So I spend a lot of time doing it.
How fast are these players?
They do some of the most incredible things that I've ever seen athletes do as far as catching a football and getting their feet in. Now, the fast ones are so fast that I'll give myself an extra 3-4 yards head start anyway, and that'll amount to maybe a 25-yard head start when I get a real fast one on my sideline anyway. So, it's hard to describe other than when I came up from the college level and moved into the NFL, I thought the guys in the Big Ten were fast. And the guys in the NFL, every one of them is fast. I mean, it is the best of the best. The linemen are fast. The linebackers are fast. When you see a Brian Urlacher go from sideline to sideline, you scratch your head and wonder, how did he get over here to make that tackle? Those are the things that amaze me on the field anyway, is how fast the defensive coverage is from sideline to sideline with some individuals. The receivers, that speaks for themselves. I mean, some of them are just so fast that, they can get up and down the field in a heartbeat.
There's a lot that's been out there recently about player concussions. Are you able to see that?
Yes. The answer is yes. And not only see it, but also hear it. There's a distinct sound when there's plastic hitting plastic, what might be a helmet-to-helmet type contact anyway. And regardless of how big the game is, when you're down on the field and you hear that sound, 99% of the time, that's helmet-to-helmet contact. We have become, in the last 3 years, probably more, there's been more emphasis and more focus on us watching receivers' heads and their helmets than there is any other part of the game. And it is just something that has been emphasized by the commissioner, by the competition committee, and also by our league supervisors anyway, is that they want us to err on the side of safety, even if it's close. They've told these players for a good 3 to 4 years now, you have to lower your target. Most of them have most of them do that. But there are your ones that still like to hit up high and like to take that chance.
Have you seen players impaired? This would be before the last 3 years, because they've been a little more sensitive to getting them out of there and testing them of lately. But have you seen players still playing who are – their bell has been clearly rung?
Well, knock on wood, the ones that I've seen anyway, they've all gotten up and they've all walked off or at least – shown some type of motion anyway as they're being carted off the field, which we never, ever like to see that. It's when you hear that sound and stuff, it is just, it sends just a tingle up your spine that you're just hoping and praying that this guy will, get up from this type of hit anyway, because they are so fast and so powerful that these hits that these linebackers and safeties and stuff put on receivers is incredible.
Okay. You mentioned earlier that football is a game, but it's not just a game. The late Major League Baseball Commissioner Bart Giamatti wrote that baseball is a reminder of how slight and fragile are the circumstances that exalt one group of human beings over another. It breaks my heart, he writes, because it was meant to foster in me again the illusion that there is something abiding, some pattern and some impulse that could come together to make a reality that would resist the corrosion. And because after it had fostered again that most hungered for illusion, the game was meant to stop and betray precisely what it promised. And he goes on to say, I need to think that something lasts forever and that it might as well be that state of being that is a game. It might as well be that in a green field in the sun. With that idea as a launching point, what's the meaning of football to you?
Oh, to me, it's a passion. I mean, it's a passion that I've loved doing ever since I played football in high school and then went on to play football at Illinois Wesleyan. It's just a passion that I've had, that I've loved the game and love being around the game. And as I've gotten older and as I've progressed through the different levels of football, I love being around the kids. They're still kids to me. When I walk on a NFL field, these are still mid-20s. They could be my children, from that standpoint. But there's a passion there that you love and that you have anyway, to not only to officiate but to be around the guys that have that same type of passion that you do. And they always say when you lose that passion, it's time for you to hang up the officiating part of it.
Okay. What story should I ask you to tell about officiating or about football?
Oh, there's so many of them, and they're so kind of micro, micro versus macro anyway, or the big picture anyway. But you've asked some of the good ones. Some of the good questions are just how good are these guys on the field? And as I've said, I cannot tell you how physically these guys do some of the things that they're capable of doing, all in an attempt to either run the ball, to catch the ball, or to throw the ball. It's not like maybe track and field or something along that line. These are incredible athletes that have incredible talents, and being a part of it is a great feeling when you're on the field that you're around these guys. And we get the opportunity to communicate with these guys during TV timeouts and what have you. We'll get the opportunity to talk to the players and talk to the coaches, and we do that a lot in the preseason, but we also do it in the regular season. And the longer you're in the league, they know who you are, and they have their scouting report on you. They know every foul that you've called in the last year, and they know your wife's name, and they know your kids' names, and so on and so forth. So it's unique in that we do get that opportunity to visit with, and 90% of the players are they know that this is their business, they know that it's their job, and they're not out to hurt anyone. If you were to see them in between plays, they're all talking to each other. They're either from the same colleges or whatever. So it's great to see that. But the minute that the lights come back on, it's a battle again. Mm-hmm. And it's just, it's great being a part of that.
What do they talk about to you in those timeouts?
Usually with us, the guys, what we're trying to do is communicate to them on, the fair play, nice hit, on the receiver, you kept it low, good interception, a nice punt return, any type of preventive officiating that we can do will help that game go a whole lot smoother. Don't hold. Don't to the defensive backs, and that's usually who we might be talking to a lot of times, the defensive backs, don't grab, don't hold, help us out.
So you can shape the course of the game with just rhetorical emphasis on certain rules.
We can, yeah, and that's, the communication part of it is huge anymore. It's and it's huge that you're doing it with the players, and it's huge that you're doing it with the coaches. The coaches want to know when their players are on the edge of fouling, or they don't want a 15-yard penalty to put them in a hole somewhere. So the coaches really appreciate when we come to them with, particular player numbers or whatever to tell them, look, he's got to back off a little bit. He can't grab. He can't restrict, so on and so forth. And there's I've yet to run into a coach that is not appreciative of that type of communication.
You mentioned Brian Urlacher earlier. What's Devin Hester like?
Fast. I mean, it's just that when he's coming out to line up on the outside, that if he runs a go pattern, you know that you got to give yourself plenty of time to turn and go, because I had him when he first came into the league. I had a Bears game with Detroit up at Soldier Field, and he literally, I think the ball was snapped from like the 15 or 20 yard line going. So he had 80 yards to cover. And at the time, I'm not sure who the quarterback was, Horton anyway, but all I remember is a three-step drop and the ball coming up into the air and Hester coming down. And I did everything I possibly could to stay in front. Our position is we would like to be in front of him rather than behind him. But after about 40 to 50 yards of that 80, I knew that my hamstrings were not going to keep up with him, and all I could do was shake my head to go, this guy is just so fast. It is incredible. He ended up catching a touchdown pass on the play and stuff.
Well, your answer raises an interesting question. What happens if you get injured in a game?
We go to six-man mechanics. We go from seven guys down to six if we have an injury. show up on a game. We do not carry an alternate referee does not come with us during regular season. Now, during the playoff games and during the Super Bowl, we actually had five alternates on the sideline that took care of the various different positions that would cover umpire, back judge, referee, so on and so forth. So if a guy goes down in the regular season, we end up working a six-man crew, and that makes it even that much tougher. Mm-hmm. So,
you ever been hurt?
Have not been hurt. I've run into a few people in my time on the sideline, but I've always managed to pick up my head and get back up again. So knock on wood, I've managed to stay away from that injury list anyway.
They're big. They hurt when they run into you.
You know, unfortunately for me, a lot of the people that I've run into have been the coaches on the sideline. I'm working a game with Michigan at Penn State, and so I had Coach Carr on my sideline, and I remember hitting him on a punt return, and his punt returner was going to run it back like 70 yards, and I remember turning and running down the sideline, and I do not remember hitting him, nor does he remember me hitting him, but he happened to be standing in the wrong place, and I knocked him out of bounds or well off of the white area that he's not supposed to be in, knocked his hat off, and actually there's a film clip of him getting up off the ground and picking up my hat and putting it on his head, thinking that it was his hat. But to give Coach Carr credit, on Monday, that Monday morning, I did receive a phone call from him asking if I was okay. He did explain that he was not able to get out of bed on Sunday morning.
My.
And the only way I can describe it is it would be like running full speed and just running into a wall. That's what it felt like anyway. So
that hurts.
Yeah, I ended up with a few bruises, but I managed to make it to next weekend's game.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for coming in for this
chat. Yeah, my pleasure, Charlie. Yeah, my pleasure.